I am going to share with you some thoughts about health disparities and the politics of culture and knowledge in public health research. So this is, it will touch on some of the ideas that Dr. Gilson and Ms. Thelma Nixon expressed, but at the same time it will build on my work. Some of the ideas in this presentation are part of the paper that I co-wrote with my colleagues David Marquez from the University of Illinois, Elena Carbon from the University of Massachusetts, Jean Marie Stachinieri from the University of Florida, and Jennifer Foster from Emory University. And there is now, as you know, an intellectual consensus in the field of public health that in order to eliminate racial and ethnic disparities, public health interventions, particularly health promotion interventions, must be culturally responsive. I wanted to say that I left some handouts from my PowerPoint presentation in the back, so you may want to check and see if you get it. The concept of cultural systems or the complexity of cultural systems and how they influence decision making and behaviors have been analyzed by some health promoters and educations in terms of the dualistic concept of deep and surface structure. And in the recent body of literature in health promotion and public health interventions, we have seen that many authors, including those that I listed in the bottom of the slide, refers to surface structures as a visible cultural expression, such as interactions and symbols, where deep structure systems refers to belief and perceptions and other cognitive templates that underline the behavior of people that we are trying to change. This analysis suggests that the focus of health promotion and health education needs to be in the complex elements of deep cultural consciousness that affect people's choices. Now, the critical need to eliminate health disparities requires that health promotion and interventionists understand how these cultural elements influence exposure, adoption and transmission of information, and behaviors associated with negative health outcomes. Now, what it is interesting is that the current body of literature in public health that have used the bionomical conceptualization of deep and surface structures have not looked back at the history of scholarship in anthropology to provide the theoretical background that exists. And as an anthropologist myself, I decided that I wanted to share with you some of the history behind this conceptualization so that we can benefit from the body of literature that anthropologists and other social scientists have created before in public health. And this raises, of course, you know, one of the politic issues in public health is that we view or conceive ourselves as theoretical and divorce many conceptualizations to sort of provide a template or a framework for some of our work. And by doing that, we miss a lot of the knowledge that could actually help us move forward in the field. And I happen to believe that that is one reason why we have not made so much progress. But I went back to Levi-Strauss' book on the structural anthropologist, because Levi-Strauss is actually the first person who used the deep and surface structures. And he did that, studied in indigenous conceptions of healing, illness, kinship, and loss in the Americas and Africa. The distinction was also widely used by Chomsky and others who developed the early foundations of linguistics, and also by Freire, who wrote an article in 1970 in the Harvard Review on cultural action for freedom. Now, what all these educators, and anthropologists and linguists agree is that the cultural structures analysis can be used both as a framework and as a methodology because it assumes a universal human need for systematically ordering, receive information, and storing at the deepest level of consciousness, and then the template of information in turn transform into surface manifestations of pre-constituted frame of reference to which people's actions conform. And so culture, as you know, is the most significant and often the sole element available to a communities for collective constructing of meaning and exchanging common shared cultural symbols and information in a specific context. And once health promoters and health educators understand the cultural context of people's lives, they can consider how cognitive cultural processes such as enculturation affect the behaviors that they want to prevent or promote with interventions in communities affected by health disparities. Okay. And so the resurrection of the bionomical conceptualization of deep surface by public health researchers to assess cultural foundations of behavioral patterns in public health education aim at addressing disparities has not acknowledged, as I said before, the previous work in a structural anthropologies, linguistic, and education. And so the absence of references in health publications on the background and the body of knowledge already built highlights to me the gap in communication between social science and public health at a time when multidisciplinary scholarship and research is vital for addressing health disparities. Next. When I look back at the body of knowledge that has been accumulated over since the 1960s, I found that there was 87 references on cultural and linguistic symbolic anthropology, that there were 32 references produced by people who were doing work in Africa, Latin America, or were feminist studies. Then in the 70s, something happened, and it was that the structurally approach was actually put aside. And it was only used by those who were in cognitive anthropology or cognitive science or religion studies. But in the 2000s, then it began to increase again with people in cultural studies revisiting Levi-Strauss and other anthropologists and their ideas. Now, one thing that I discovered when I went back was the work of W.W. Nobles. He applied the binomial distinction, deep surface in cultural structures, in his work with African Americans and African American families in the 1970s and 80s. And he laid the foundation for most recent scholarship on cultural identity and Afrocentrism. So is it unclear from the literature if he was influenced or not by a structural anthropologist and Levi-Strauss, but he was—he has been cited by Linda James Myers in some of the papers that she has published in Black Psychology, as well as a book that she wrote where she has a chapter on the deep structure, and she begins to link the experience of African Americans in this country with the experience of Africans in Africa. Now, a recent article by Jack and his colleagues in the Annals of Internal Medicine discussing environmental issues and diabetes self-management is the only reference that goes back to the W.W. Nobles and James Myers' work. Now, the new generations of structuralists in the field of cultural studies have distanced themselves from Levi-Strauss' static and deterministic definition of deep structure. Nonetheless, they have adopted two of his main ideas, that structures for specific actions and meaning are embedded in a relationship among elements of the whole culture rather than individual elements, and that inner knowledge is observable in all oral narrative and other forms of verbal textual data susceptible to a structural analysis. Now, the new structuralists in cultural studies and to some extent in Latino studies have reconceptualized the notion of deep structures as multiple dynamic entities that have continued to transform over time by people's schemas within the structural constraints of social relationships and interactions in local, global, and transnational contexts. By blending the Levi-Straussian approach with other postmodern orientations from interpretive constructivist anthropology, cultural studies seek to understand how human behavior is influenced by the relationships between cultural elements in the deep structures and individual agency. Next. And so I decided to look at how these distinction between deep and surface structures would apply to one of the Latino populations in this country. And I use Puerto Ricans as an example because Puerto Ricans have the worst indicators of general health status among Latino groups and because also Puerto Ricans are the group that is more segregated in terms of enclaves, and because the poor indicators that are frequently explained by limited access to health information and health education services. Now, the lack of access to health information undermines prevention of self-care behaviors, utilization of the healthcare system. Lack of access to health information also has been linked to low levels of English proficiency for obtaining information about health insurance. And some of the things that were mentioned before applies here. Key to the Puerto Ricans' cultural identity, and I'm going to go through the next one because I know that I'm running out of time. So key to the Puerto Rican cultural identities is the history of colonialism, but the deepest structures the theory that are behind the conception of these deepest structures have been described as historically specific patterns that often bring to light structures underlining the cultural meaning of speech and behaviors in day-to-day social interactions. Now, cultural identity significantly influenced learning processes and preferences. And acknowledge as a basic human right, the Universal Declaration of Cultural Diversity, passed by UNESCO in 1995, states that the process provides a sense of belonging and identification when one past, present, and future community, and as Ms. Nixon was saying before, we have the tendency to forget the past. So to understand the deep structures of Puerto Rican culture, health promoters need to understand the historical context of their national and linguistic identities before deciphering other macro-level determinants of health, including colonialism and, as I mentioned before, Puerto Rican collective cultural consciousness reflects the history of colonialism, and Spanish language is a vital component of communication of resistance to the perceived or real colonial threat. Since Puerto Rico was occupied in 1898, generations of island-born Puerto Ricans had been exposed to U.S. culture and language. Generations of Puerto Ricans also have commuted between the two countries. Frequent visit to the island allows Puerto Ricans to maintain a strong family ties and very strong social networks. And as you can see from my slide, I have a plane because we are often called in the social science literature as a commuter nation. The study, let's see. Oh, the only thing that I wanted to say, because I'm running out of time, is that the color makes a difference. And a recent work by Borrell, an article in American Journal of Public Health, highlights the fact that within Puerto Rican communities, we have to look at not only class and gender and age, but also color. In the context of Puerto Rican sociolinguistic dynamics, where language becomes not a very appropriate measure for acculturation, given the fact that we are exposed to English language and the U.S. culture before we come here. The next one. Okay, so the study of cultural structures focuses on the relationship between visible behaviors and social actions, that is the surface, and the deeper structures of meaning acquired over time through enculturation or inculcation. These deeper structures involve the consciousness and unconscious acquisition of competency to sense and decode meaning, to interpret experience, and to perform in a particular cultural context. And that is, I want to highlight that we need to pay attention to how we use cultural competency, because the cultural identity and the deepest structures that guide our behaviors and our ideas may not be changed as easy as we think, and it may take long time, and so a cultural competence in training is not going to do much for many people who have to learn a lot of information about how to address the needs of a particular community. So I am going to skip, given the fact that I was the last speaker and I don't have much time, but I want to highlight that, and maybe I should probably get out of my script. I want to highlight that the literature have pointed to some spaces that are very important in public health interventions for Puerto Ricans, and that is faith-based spaces, bodegas of small grocery stores, and community parks and other spaces for informal sports activities, that these are settings where interventions will be successful. Now, Dr. Gibson mentioned the explanatory legitimization theory, and I don't know much about that theory, but there has been a call in the literature, particularly anthropologists who are working in public health, for the use of cultural explanatory models, which are similar to what you mentioned, and that is that we can actually look at both the providers and the residents of the community perspective about some of the same issues. And if you want more information, I would be happy to refer you to the cultural assessment framework that developed by Hughes and Klein from 1999, and the cultural explanatory models that have been now used widely, that dates back to the 1980s with Arthur Kleinman, another anthropologist. And they use also of narrative analysis. And, you know, the thing about that, that I think the message that I want to bring to you is that the knowledge that we have created with quantitative methods and positivist approaches to research have not moved us far enough. And that oftentimes what we see now is research projects aim at addressing disparities with the same traditional methodologies and the same cultures that we have used before, and it's just that now we sort of have reframed the focus of the study. And I am concerned that if we continue to conduct research in that way, we will not be able to really understand what is going on in communities affected for by disparities. And so I think that in order to really begin to use research to eliminate health disparities, we need to change the culture and to begin look at the body of literature produced by outside public health. And although, like I said before, some public health researchers do that, they divorce completely some of the concepts from the theory, and they also try to use some of the theories that has been built on qualitative research into more quantitative approaches, and that makes it very difficult to create more knowledge, the type of knowledge that we need to address health disparities. So we need to begin, I think, changing the culture in public health for both, I believe, the type of research that we do, as well as what is legitimized as public health research. We also have to look at NIH, CDC, and other research funders' policies and mechanisms to move beyond the words transdisciplinary into requiring the integration of multiple perspectives, such as that of the field of cultural studies and critical race theory, into health disparities research. And we need our professional organizations, such as the American Association of Public Health, to create incentive from national, at the national level, as well as the academic journals, for researchers to really get out the box, create new methodologies that capture the experience of people and give us insights into how we need to approach the disparities that exist in our communities. Thank you. I'm sorry, it was a long presentation to pack it in 50 minutes.
Okay, thank you all panel members. It was a richness of and diversity of the presentations there, I think, is really, really interesting. So we'll open it up for questions and answers. I believe we have around 15 minutes, more or less. And we don't have a microphone out there, right? And we don't have it on the table here either, so can't take it off. So we'll have to just do it without. So maybe I'll start off with a question myself for all panel members, is because I heard some movements and transformation and so on. Any thoughts from any or all of you on giving some tips along what I present initially to the politicians who are running for president, for example, or all these agencies that were mentioned, you know, et cetera. Would that be of any help in terms of the movement and the transformation? Anybody?
Providing input to any of the campaigns. And I don't think your question is about
all the money that has been invested so far in health disparities initiative in all our communities across this country, and then how much we have been able to accomplish in terms of process and what are the outcomes. I question that because we continue to have the same approaches to do the work. And so we call it differently, but it is the same. Right. And what I feel we need to do is begin to create a national movement for, and I agree with Dr. Rios, but also the national movement needs to be about not only the creation of new policies, but the creation of the transformation. For example, I do believe that every government employee needs to have in their job description a statement that says that they are going to follow the policy for health disparities, just like we do with sexual harassment and equal opportunity. And when there are job descriptions posted, that it says that part of the job is to meet the objective for the elimination of health disparities.
Okay.
That is something that happens at the agency level. It could be a national policy, too.
Stephen had something to say.
Yeah. For me, I think there are two or three areas that seem critical for us to consider. One is looking at research and policy and the differences in the experience of populations in rural settings versus urban settings. Because much of the research and much of the propensity for research is really geared on an urban-based model, an urban-based demographic model. And when you're working in rural settings, to even come up with some of the research funding dollars, and you put in a model that reflects the cultural complexity of rural communities, you're often knocked out of federal funding for that. So part of what we don't know is we don't see what are some of the dynamics that might be occurring in Montana or Wyoming versus New York. The other thing that I think is to revisit the whole conversation about health literacy. And I actually stole this from Elizabeth. Again, the person I'm her husband. The issue about when the health literacy model at some level assumes that if I have that information, that then it's my responsibility to do something. Meanwhile, the tobacco companies can move on and continue to sell me those products. Mm-hmm. And there's nothing that we're doing to hold corporate responsibility for those things that they're bringing into my community. And the second thing about health literacy issues is to begin looking at the level of cognitive access of that information. Right. So right. Not only is it, I mean, clearly we think of the rehabilitation we have to have an electronic 508 access, and most of our departments of health in the United States their websites don't meet that. But once we meet that, the next step is having the health information available to multiple literacy levels. So that if I have completed second grade or third grade, regardless of the reason why I've completed that, or whatever, that I can access that healthcare information. Because one of the interesting things recently looked at access to tobacco cessation and quitting smoking information in our state. And I suspect we're no different than the other state. But most of the information is written at a 10th grade or 13th grade level. So if you've not completed 10th grade, you're not going to be able to access that information and digest it. So you don't know what it means. So we have to begin thinking about health literacy in terms of multiple levels of access and not just multiple languages of access.
And there is an aspect of health literacy that is related to culture. So in addition to the grade levels, there is cultural constructions, the assessments that I mentioned, part of what I think are good tools to gather cultural information is because they give us the language and the structure of the language that we need in order to communicate better with people from different levels of literacy.
Thank
so
you.
There is, in my opinion, a difference between functional literacy, health literacy, and cultural aspects of the production of knowledge, of the processing. I didn't get into that, but the cognitive processing of information happens within the cultural template that has been
Thank you. There are a few questions, I believe, from the audience, so let's start here. We've got to go upstream much, much more than we've been doing on affecting or evaluating the impact. Yes?
You know, one of the things I was wondering about is, what do you think in the public discourse about distinguishing between medical care and public health? How do we get that across? How do we somehow make that important distinction? To make that distinction important?
Takers? There's a question in the back.
Right.
But go ahead.
Essentially,
Thank you. So we're pretty much out of time. Are there any final burning comments, questions, observations, concerns? I don't see any. Thank you very much. It was a great session.